I'm Christopher Lydon in New Haven, asking the Sterling Professor of English at Yale, David Brumwich, to locate us by the language of this campaign year, 2012. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. David Brumwich, you've taken us in the past through the masters of ideas and words on the scale of Abraham Lincoln and Edmund Burke. Take us through the language of this campaign year.
We see the leaders of both parties, the candidates, Obama and Romney, I think struggling to find the right words to put forward domestic policies which their respective parties have stood for at least for half a century. The Republican Party is the party of privilege. The Democratic is the party of slightly less privilege and some conscience for people who are in need, but the difference would be easy to overrate, and we see that in the way both candidates have to court Wall Street.
David, I'm in a 50-year head. It's 50 years since John F. Kennedy addressed my graduating class at Yale. We know now it wasn't exactly Camelot, and in fact, we were 5 months away from the Cuban Missile Crisis, which almost turned all the lights out. But it does feel like many, many watersheds crossed. How does a literary scholar of public language take the measure of just what's changed in the country?
Well, Kennedy was going on the recent memory of his troubles with big business and price fixing by steel and other large industries. And that Yale commencement speech, which I listened to because you told me about it, comes to grips with the problem of big money treating itself as if it had an exemption from the social contract. And Kennedy acknowledges the presence of organized labor, at least by implication, as well as big business, and tries to speak of the country as having all one interest in the long run. But he's not sentimental about it, and he is not merely rhetorical about it. It's a speech full of reference to the details of economic progress and the new Republican emphasis on the national debt. He sees Goldwater coming, that side of the party that in opposition getting stronger. So I think that speech is involved very persistently, almost exclusively, with issues of domestic policy. And in that way, it resembles very much our own time. I mean, we're not going to see in this election year, it seems, much argument over foreign policy, where the Republicans and Democrats are pretty much in agreement. The policy of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton is not markedly different from what one could imagine the policy would have been of George Bush and Condoleezza Rice, not Cheney, but Rice, had they been given another 4 years. So the differences are on economic policy, but they're not being marked out as clearly, even as they could be by Kennedy. And he was, I think, firmer than any of our leaders now about the need to, as he put it, sort of paraphrasing Lincoln, disenthrall ourselves from an inheritance of truisms and stereotypes, and speaking, too, against what he called the danger of myth. Now, I think he had in mind the myth of the self-made man, the myth of the American dream, the myth of what we now call American exceptionalism, though he did not speak in particulars against it. Now, in our time, the leaders of the Democratic Party have utterly assimilated themselves to these notions of exceptionalism. I think perhaps Barack Obama, defensively and in compensation for what he fears may be perceptions about him as an outsider, has absorbed more of the stereotypes and truisms of the American dream and American exceptionalism and so on than any previous Democrat, not even excluding Bill Clinton.
And of course he seems to embody it too.
Yes.
I mean, in his story.
Yes, his good fortune and the exceptional character of his progress from Indonesia to Hawaii to California to New York to working in Chicago to Harvard Law School to, you know, his quick progress through the Senate to the presidency, all this is has almost the quality of a miracle, and I think he's impressed with that too, and he's tempted to use it as an epitome of something, and he does use it so.
Stick with the Kennedy speech for a moment. I remember it for two things, especially the opening in which he said he now had the best of all possible worlds, Harvard education and a Yale degree, which infuriated a lot of the old blues. But then it was a tax cut speech. It was sort of Reaganism before Reagan, and Walter Lippmann had sort of talked him into it.
Yes. Yeah. It is a speech, the content of which is trimming to a great extent, though the explanatory substance of it is a defense of the limited welfare state that the United States enjoyed at that time and was really part of what some of us call the New Deal settlement.
As I remember it, we thought in 1962 we were part of an aspiring middle-class society, and we know, of course, that we were in an extraordinary post-war boom. We live today in a kind of deep state plutocracy that seems to be at the edge of implosion. I mean, how did we get there?
I mean, rough and ready, the facts are that industry was leaving the country already in the 70s, and Reagan's tax breaks and subsequent developments, largely commandeered by Republicans, but also by just Wall Street money, which is nonpartisan, helped the big industries to leave the heartland and even places like Connecticut. And the availability of credit cards and home mortgages hid the effects of all this from us for a long time. And the collapse of the housing bubble and the revelation of the extraordinary risks Wall Street bankers and money firms had been taking has now left us with this knowledge we don't know what to do with, because we're still all sleepwalking in the American dream.
This is, to me, the most interesting part of the whole plot, that we all know something has deeply shifted, and yet we can't confirm it either. The New York Times doesn't tell us. It's not part of the public discourse. A great deal of this happened, underground. And there is no language for it.
Well, there's the language of books that have attained some currency, readership, popularity, books like Ron Susskind, account of the president's economic team called Confidence Men, and movies like the Ferguson documentary Inside Job. Those are highly informative, and, a popular performer like Matt Damon was able to perform a civic duty and inform himself even more and conduct some highly embarrassing and revealing interviews with economists and, academic experts on economics. So it's out there in plain view, but as you say, hidden too. It's not part of the common discourse. I think the closest we came to public acknowledgement of it was the slogan, "We are the 99%, the Occupy Wall Street slogan.
Yeah.
Now that became a narrative about police clearance of the parks and other public places that the protesters were occupying. And no substantial part of the Democratic Party, except in the state of Wisconsin, came to back up the protest. But that was reminiscent of the 30s. And I think, in fact, the slogan, "We are the 99%, is the best and truest political slogan of a declining middle class that I've heard in the last couple of decades. It should catch on, and people, as they try to explain its meaning to themselves, will maybe do some of the research that is suitable to citizens.
At the same time, it's the Tea Party at the other end that has seized one of the two alternatives, which could even win.
Yes, you have a fanatical sect within a party that runs the party that now has a majority in the House of Representatives and may end up with a majority in both houses of Congress and perhaps the White House as well. That's true, and I think one of the great defaults of Democratic Party leadership and of the left liberal side in politics in these last two or three years has been a failure to respond directly, not just to misstatements or lies or deliberate distortions by the Tea Party, but to respond to their view of American society and American economic relations. I think there's been a real failure of imagination there, starting at the top. I wrote a column a few months ago for the Huffington Post asking why Barack Obama had never answered or tried to refute or even called by name and attempted some sort of rebuttal to the Tea Party. He tried to assimilate them to his own views and said, it's in our DNA, we are all against taxes, aren't we? Well, no, not in the same way, and Democrats certainly since FDR, not in the same way. But there is this tremendous timidity in the face of a network-supported, billionaire-supported, but nevertheless popular movement on the far right of the Republican Party, which runs the Republican Party. How the Democrats expect to manage their relation to the fact of the Tea Party in future years, I just don't know. I don't see any account being taken of it.
One of the things I wake up to 50 years later is that I grew up in a social democracy. We didn't call it that, but it was a distributed prosperity. People like me and my sibs all went through first-rate colleges on scholarship. There was a social investment in whatever gifts we and many, many people like us had, but we didn't have, even then, we didn't really have a name for what it was, and social democracy, even that would have sounded strange in that time.
It sounds European.
It does. And yet it was a marvelous thing, and it kept expanding, in fact, through the Nixon administration, in the sense of environmental regulation, poverty programs, urban aid, revenue sharing, all that kind of thing. Will we ever have a language for what seemed the state of things, what we called America?
Well, I've thought for a long time and wrote half a book about it 20 years ago that the left liberal side in American politics and education has lost control of any language of protest or dissidence. It happened because of political correctness, and political correctness is a left-wing malady.
Where did political correctness make itself an obstacle?
Well, when you listen to the Tea Party radio hosts, the you know, the brokers of that sort of intemperate protest, you hear people who are very good at mugging the other side rhetorically and using a language that has some salt and savor in it. They'll use words like rascals and come to the verge of using words like bastards and so on. It's a street language, but not all the way over into obscenity or transgressive offense. All that kind of language has been scrubbed from the language of, from the usage of the liberal left. And it happened from a number of sources, one of which was feminism, and the need to be sensitive to using the wrong words about formerly persecuted or discriminated against groups. But think of all the different names that have been contrived for us to refer to every former minority, or even, you know, sex, which is not a minority, in order to give less and less offense. I mean, some of it is a necessity of progress, but it also curbs people and their imagination of what it is to feel vehemence, to feel the emotion of conviction. It curbs it to an extraordinary extent. I see it in the classroom, and sometimes when I revert to a language which I learned in the 1950s and 60s, and I don't mean dirty talk at all, I can see the eyebrows go up among the students and think, should I report this? There isn't any of that kind of curb, any of that kind of self-inhibition on the other side. And I'm afraid that's a very large symptom of the problem any reformist party now faces.
Give an example of what you're missing. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, Paul Krugman called the Bush economists liars. What's the restraint that's handicapping the left?
Well, the strongest language I can recall hearing from people like Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are the words "not helpful." They use those words again and again. This is not helpful. It's a schoolmarm phrase. Mm. By the way, I've just indulged in a political incorrectness by using the word schoolmarm. Mm. So there's a word I'd have to cross out. It's a female school teacher's phrase. So you begin to get an idea of the problem. Now, what would the Republicans say instead of not helpful? Corrupt, depraved. and worse than offensive, poisonous, you know. And this is a language that comes down to us from 18th century political pamphleteering and cartooning and so on. It's a legitimate language colored by satire that digs deep. And, you know, I think it used to be street corner orators, union leaders, Democrats with some working class, granular knowledge of what society felt like all around, who gave us, a fair portion of that on the left. They aren't there anymore. It is mostly academically trained, scrupulous and conscientious people who are dissident in some way or want to see society made better in a way that even goes against their own interests, people the best of whom may be represented now by somebody like Elizabeth Warren, whom we rely on for language, and hers is a lot better than Hillary Clinton's or Barack Obama's, but it's still, there is not, I think, the popular touch.
David, speak of the language that sort of sustains the sense of a triumphant empire that in a world that's just waiting for us to exert power, et cetera, et cetera. After the bottom has, in many ways, fallen out, not only in debt, but undermining the more or less roughly aspiring equality of our own society, but most especially the imperial embarrassments in a series now from Vietnam through Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, what is the language that sustains the kind of obliviousness of our talk?
I think it's a language of dreamlike self-forgetfulness, and that, its best example, and I've written about this once or twice, might be both the narrative and the diction of Barack Obama's Nobel Prize acceptance speech in 2009, which was all about the American benevolent reign of international power after the Second World War. The whole story told there was about this country sacrificing itself for the good of the world, and of course, not without some self-regarding motive. But that's the dream. That's what Kennedy was saying we should not be enthralled by. If you want to, and I thought this was what you were asking at first, if you want to imagine what it would be like for an empire that's undergone disasters such as ours to confront itself so as not completely to weaken its claim to justice. I think one source of such an acknowledgement might be an appeal to the rule of law, including law governing ourselves. And that would have to mean looking at the recent past, but not only saying words about it, but following up actions, including actions against those who have most gone against constitutional principles and the way the law should be understood in the United States. Now, this administration has not cared to do that. That's the strategy Burke followed when he saw that England had lost what he called the empire in the West, and he wanted it not to lose the empire in the East, that is, India. So he instigated an impeachment of the Governor General of Bengal and brought to the bar of, British justice, that is, the House of Commons, what it was that we had done wrong in India. So, he made a spectacle, but not a merely spectacular tribunal, out of a demonstration of the good of the rule of law, and constitution and law were central words to that effort. I wish that this president would speak the phrase rule of law once a week. I don't know that he has spoken that word with a proper emphasis three times in his 3 years in office. So, there is this falling back on what we're used to hearing. Mention of the American dream, we're still as strong as ever, etc.
To talk about the rule of law was, and include us in it would certainly make it more comfortable to confront the Assad regime in Syria, for example.
Well, that's a business where everyone involved has to tread with care, because the wrong steps would threaten the United States in a regional war that could expand, and you don't want Russia on the wrong side of such an adventure. The problem that President Obama, with his high-minded rhetoric and short-sighted actions, got himself trapped in with the Libya intervention was that he seemed to be for humanitarian pursuits, such as the overthrowing of a dictator who was killing his own people. And when he makes an exception to that, he looks as if he's created a second standard just for convenience and just for the moment. But I think, you know, the principle of some sort of law, both national and international, you want to abide by, is all important. But I'm keener, as left and right wing libertarians are, and I count myself among them. I'm keener on the upholding of the Constitution for ourselves and as an example to others than I am on spreading the good word of what the United States can mean to you in the world.
Hmm. Are you saying you're a sort of left-wing Ron Paul, as I often feel myself?
Ron Paul is the most candid politician of national stature in the United States today as we speak, in the, you know, the middle of 2012. Ron Paul's anti-interventionism puts right out in the open and with enormous candor truths about the history of American foreign policy and its disasters over the last 30 years that nobody else in either party has dared to utter. Now, I find him one of the few sources of whatever hope a limited exposure of truths can give in a time like this.
I've been so impressed by Tony Judt's last book, or one of the last, that he spoke as he was dying of Lou Gehrig's disease, but especially Ill Fares the Land, and the whole reminder about the value of social democracy, and especially those fundamental public institutions of healthcare, public transportation, and public education through the college level, basically as a common investment in a common prosperity. What would it take, other than, you know, prayer and a great deal of wishful thinking, to get something of that language into the realistic conversation of our politics?
Well, it might take leaders who believed in public life, in real transparency and accountability, and in, I should add, public education, more than our present leaders on the left liberal side can show. This might be a place to remember public rhetoric of a different sort. For example, a passage or two from Martin Luther King.
Please remind us.
Well, there are interesting moments in Martin Luther King's leadership of the civil rights movement, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which is a Christian movement, the Baptist Church at the heart of it. But people forget how some of those moments that seem most distinctive in King's career came out of his own separation from elements of the movement. I mean, two of his greatest pieces of, in one case writing and in the other speaking, the 1963 letter from Birmingham jail, and then his speech coming out against the Vietnam War in April 1967, both of these were controversial because they were not reaffirming the ideology of the movement, but in a way acknowledging the sense of isolation he felt and hitting out against a lack of support, a lack of strength to pursue protest from people he had counted as allies. I'll take not from the great, very remarkable, and also sustained speech against the Vietnam War from 1967, which was deplored by the majority of his associates in the civil rights movement, but I'll take from an interview he gave a few months later when the controversy was still going, an answer he gave to a question by a reporter who wondered out loud how King could set up as an anti-war dissident when his whole stature depended on civil rights and nothing but civil rights. And his answer is this. This is July 1967 at a press conference. I'm a clergyman. I was a clergyman before I was a civil rights leader, and when I was ordained to the Christian ministry, I accepted that as a commission to constantly and forever bring the ethical insights of our Judeo-Christian heritage to bear on the social evils of our day. And I happen to think war is one of the major evils facing mankind. Secondly, it would be foolhardy for me to work for integrated schools or integrated lunch counters and not be concerned about the survival of the world in which to be integrated. Third, I have worked too long now and too hard to get rid of segregation in public accommodations to turn back to the point of segregating my moral concern. Justice is indivisible. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And wherever I see injustice, I'm going to take a stand against it, whether it's in Mississippi or in Vietnam. Now, you can hear that, you know, I can't do his voice, but you can hear even in the tonality of the words, just what a clear and simple statement of conscience is there. And I think that draws, to use a metaphor from Emerson, that draws the world toward it. It draws whole worlds toward it when people see that sense of a man planting himself on his convictions. I mentioned earlier the rule of law. I think that's a simple article of belief that could rally many. And I think that belief that war is wrong, that war is the leading evil that human beings commit, could also rally people. But we don't see war being talked down. We don't see things being said against the very idea of war. I mean, a think tank luminary, Michael O'Hanlon, I noticed in a recent New York Times editorial, actually referred in a phrase to our current round of wars. And this is new in my experience. I'm 60 years old now, and I never heard so many Americans talk so acceptingly about wars in the plural. And you feel that we are Rome or something, and that people have resigned themselves to that. It is a very strange situation we're in, and yet under Obama, after Bush, the number of wars has increased. And his chief innovation in language is to speak of war more generally, more elusively, more vaguely, and in a softer tone. But now to publicize his own actions, you know, as a decider on the killing of individuals, including American citizens if need be. So that's a terrible sinking back into the lethargy of, well, it's just where we are. There are earlier movements than the one many of us are familiar with from the 1960s, the civil rights movement or the anti-war movement of a slightly later time, that have promoted, what shall we say, retractions, reversals of injustice and a kind of self-examination among Americans that also gave new energy to reform. Before that, there was the progressive movement leading to the early days of the labor movement. And, you know, this is a presence in our culture that American writers, even some of the most original of American poets in the early 20th century responded one way or another, but it was a vivid fact of life. I've lately been going back over poems by Vachel Lindsay, a poet I like a lot, isn't read that much or talked about that much these days. But he has a wonderful long poem, I can't read all of it, about William Jennings Bryan coming to Springfield, Illinois in 1896 in his campaign against McKinley and Mark Hanna, the plutocrat. He takes it as a childhood memory and lays it on pretty thick but wonderful about what it was to taste the air of that progressive atmosphere of those years. I'll just read you a bit of his poem, which is called, I believe, Bryan, 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 four Bryans. And I'll read you parts 2 and 3 of the poem. When Bryan came to Springfield, an Altgeld gave him greeting. Rochester was deserted. De Vernon was deserted. Mechanicsburg, Riverton, Chicken Bristle, Cotton Hill, empty. For all Sangamon drove to the meeting in silver-decked racing cart. Buggy, buckboard, carryall, carriage, phaeton, whatever would haul, and silver-decked farm wagons gritted, banged, and rolled with the new tale of Brian by the iron tires hold. The state house loomed afar, a speck, a hive, a football, a captive balloon, and the town was all one spreading wing of bunting, plumes, and sunshine, every rag and flag and Brian picture sold, when the rigs in many a dusty line jammed our streets at noon and joined the wild parade against the power of gold, because Brian was for free silver. That's how you defeated the plutocrats. We roamed, wee boys from high school, with mankind, while Springfield gleamed silk-lined. Oh, Tom Dines and Art Fitzgerald and the gangs that they could get. I can hear them yelling yet, helping the incantation, defying aristocracy with every bridle gone, ridding the world of the low-down mean, bidding the eagles of the West fly on, bidding the eagles of the West fly on. So that's the Progressive Party remembered from someone who experienced progressive silence descend on Springfield, Illinois at the age of 16.
The Bucks of Springfield.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where are you, Rachel Lindsay? Now that we need you.
Well, Dylan is a reasonably close approximation, but I'm afraid not the recent Dylan. We'll have to look to something new and something else.
David Brumage, thank you. It's a joy to draw on your love of rhetoric, your knowledge of rhetoric, to hear what we're hearing today and not hearing. Thank you. This is always a treat for me.
Same here.
David Brumage is the Sterling Professor of English at Yale. His political essays appear in the London and New York reviews of books and in the Huffington Post. Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until listeners like you add your two bits in a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. Our next round will be all about a tilt toward a new inequality in America, how it happened, who's getting hurt. Join us. I'm Christopher Lighton. Thank you for being part of these conversations.